Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. This is another episode in the Sheldrake-Vernon Dialogues, and I'm here with Mark Vernon.
Hello, Rupert.
We talk to each other about things we're thinking about, reading about, currently interested in. And our aim in these conversations is, first of all, to have a conversation with each other, because we enjoy bouncing ideas off each other, and also hoping that these will help other people to follow up with discussions with their friends and thinking about these same questions. The subject I wanted to explore with you today, Mark, is sacred spaces. And I mention this not just in a generic sense, but in a specific sense, because some cathedrals in Britain have now started a program called Sacred Spaces. And I went to one at Lincoln Cathedral last month. They do them monthly at Lincoln. Lincoln's my favourite cathedral. It's a very powerful place. And what happens in their sacred space programme is that you go there in the evening. This one was at 7 o'clock. And it's when the cathedral's closed to tourists and visitors and pilgrims. It's just a space to be. Well, you can be there as a pilgrim. It's actually a very good way to be there as a pilgrim in the sacred space period. And you go into the cathedral, and what happened when we went in, to my surprise, was that there were some tables just inside the cathedral with homely ladies and kindly gentlemen serving cups of tea and cakes and biscuits. And this was very homely, and this enormously powerful space, one felt, you know, quite at home, and there were other people who were part of it, and people were chatting, and I talked to some people who'd been to previous ones and absolutely loved it, and so it made you feel welcome and part of a little community. Then we went into the Angel Choir, where one of the priests there, a woman priest, gave a short introduction and a blessing on our time. And they had a number of activities in different parts of the cathedral. That evening, clay modelling was one, so they had a table and clay, so if people wanted to express a creative impulse through modelling, they could do that. There was another place where people could sit quietly in a side chapel, and then with contemplative Bible readings going on. Another one where there was a priest who you could go and talk to if you wanted a personal conversation. So there were a number of different activities. But the main thing was that you could just be there, just be in the space. I personally wasn't very into clay modelling or any of the other activities. For me, what was so exciting was to be in the cathedral, dimly lit in the evening, with the freedom to go anywhere. The whole cathedral was open. And one of the things I love doing in cathedrals is lying on the floor and looking up at the vaulting, and you get a sense of complete immersion in the space. Now, I normally don't feel free to do that, because I think if I do it, but I do it surreptitiously, because I'm afraid if people see me lying on the floor that either they'll come with a coronary resuscitation device or a verger will come and say, "Can I help you?" or something like that. And I don't feel relaxed about it. This time, just to be sure, I asked one of the younger priests there, there were a few scattered around the cathedral. I said, "Is it all right to lie on the floor?" And he said, "Yes, do feel free." And so I was able to go around the cathedral, all the bits I've always wanted to lie down and immerse myself in the vaulting. I could do that, and it was wonderful to do that. Then another thing I like doing is go right up to close to the high altar, where there's a rail you can kneel down and pray in that very special place. And normally, if there were visitors walking around, I'd feel very self-conscious doing that. So I had a most wonderful time in the sacred space in Lincoln Cathedral, and a number of other cathedrals have started doing it. At Southall, Southwell, I think they're doing it, and at Canterbury Cathedral they're doing it. This is new. This has started at the end of 2019, and a few cathedrals are doing it and more are thinking of doing it. And it provides a way of being in the space, where the space, the sense of presence in that space can act directly, and you can do it in a way where you don't feel self-conscious. Another form of sacred space that I wanted to mention again, new, is that in Hampstead Parish Church, which is where I usually go to church, they have just started during Lent doing compline on Sunday evenings, night prayers, this lovely 15-minute, very calming ancient service in plain chant. But it's preceded by half an hour of silence. And sitting there in the choir stalls of Hampstead Parish Church in the silence before compline has turned out for me to be an incredibly powerful experience of peaceful presence, much more conducive to prayer and meditation than just doing it at home. And of course one can go into most churches, many Anglican and almost all Catholic churches are open during the daytime, and one can go into a church anytime. If you are on a weekday and there's hardly anyone around, sacred space can be any time. And actually, this is something I've done for years. You know, in New York City, for example, I now know where all the best churches are. And when I feel the need for a bit of refreshment in that bustling city, I go and sit quietly in one of these churches. And I light a candle, say a prayer, and then just sit quietly for a while and allow the space to work on me and be present in it. And I find this a very powerful practice. And I wondered if you've had similar experiences.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just on the in terms of being silent in buildings, I actually helped run a silent group at Southwark Cathedral in South London, which is another building with its own kind of quality and presence. And I think it's really nice for us in the group because we go to Southwark Cathedral for services, say, or we pass it on our bikes when we're cycling around. And it's really fascinating, actually, and to have a completely different experience of the place through being silent in it. Or actually, it's quite often around it, I should say, because we often meet in one of the meeting rooms, but there's something still about being in the aura of the building itself. That is very good to share an experience just by being silent for half an hour. It makes me think, I suppose, put it another way, how you approach a sacred space opens up different aspects of the sacred space. Mm. You know, if you go to a very grand occasion with wonderful music and processions and so on, and that is inspiring perhaps in one way. Mm. But I, maybe like you're hinting and suggesting, I very much like trying to go for the quiet, open, undetermined way of approaching, say, cathedrals or big churches or little churches, you know, very ancient Celtic Saxon churches. I was in Repton a few days ago before speaking now, and the person who was hosting me there said, "Oh, we must go into Repton Parish Church because there's a Saxon crypt underneath the church, and very simple, but with these very lovely Saxon stone columns, which are quite rare because stone is quite rare in Saxon buildings. They had just a very simple but nice swirl around them, and you know, we stood in this simple space just slightly beneath the ground now, and we're connected back to people who, you know, have been in that space for centuries. Just a little gesture like lighting a candle just kind of opens you up to that presence. I didn't then think of it indefinitely, but the rest of my time in Repton was somehow marked by the fact I touched base with something that had been there since the 7th century or before. Mm. That sense of how a sacred space can drop you into a kind of grounded presence is really powerful and wonderful. I'm glad too, just to add to the what's happening amongst the English cathedrals, because as well as sacred space, in 2020, my brother is a canon at Bury St Edmunds Cathedral, originally a very ancient religious site in this country, and so it's 1,000 years since the founding of Bury St Edmunds Cathedral, and this year they're involved with all the pilgrimages and opening up cathedrals and so on in lots of different ways. So just more generally, watch out for what your local cathedral might have on, because it'll have the sacred space program perhaps, but also other things, particularly for this year, 2020. It's quite a significant year, strangely enough, for lots of cathedrals, in fact.
Yes. Well, it is here in Britain, has been proclaimed by the Association of English Cathedrals, the Year of Pilgrimage and of Cathedrals. And I know they have a programme that all of them are planning to have at least one cathedral night when the cathedrals open at night. And sacred space actually is a perfect way of doing it. Because a normal church service is a torrent of words. I mean, I have a problem with regular services. I mean, I go to them and they're a big part of my life, but the sheer number of words that you get, there's all the words in the hymns, the words in the service, the words in the prayers, the words in the sermon, the words in the Bible readings. It's like total saturation with words. And so this other way of being in churches in silence is a wonderful counterbalance to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm a bit quite wary of churches, really, in terms of church services, because I feel that what they do offer is, apart from the torrent of words, is also, it's quite sort of monocultural. It's essentially you standing before the priest or standing before you know, what's going on in the high place, to receive blessings, to receive communion. Now, there's nothing wrong with that per se, but it can become a bit of a, you know, a kind of too much of a samey kind of diet. Mm. A spiritual diet. And so going to these buildings where the space itself makes you search for a kind of response, you know, in that tremendous presence. And I think that calls for something from within you as much as just leaves you slightly passive receiving from the priest. Part of the reason why I like going into these buildings now when there's not a service on quite deliberately is because I think that it's a much more interactive experience, strangely enough, because you'd think that standing and sitting and singing and responding was the more interactive. But at a subtler level, I think going into the emptiness of a sacred space, which of course is actually very full, brings forth something in you that it's hard to find in other ways.
Well, I agree. I mean, in my case, it's not either or, it's sort of both and. I mean, I like going to services because that gives a communal dimension. I like being able to sing with other people and pray with other people. So I don't just see it as the priest. I see it as a collective activity. And then, you know, meeting people after the service. I mean, it's a way of building community, and I think it actually works. And in many parts of Britain, at least, it's almost the only thing left in the centre of each village or town that does have a sense of community. So I think there's a great value in it. But being in the space in silence is much more contemplative, meditative, and actually spiritually connecting, I think. But as I say, I think it doesn't have to be either or. And this particular evenings with Compline preceded by silence is a quite wonderful way of combining them, actually. I'd not encountered it before they started doing it in Hampstead Parish Church this Lent. And the silence, as I say, was extraordinarily profound for me and for others who've been there. And then the Compline, where there's plain chant, where you're singing together, again, it brings you together in this ancient liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me a perfect combination, actually.
Yeah, and the wonderful thing about Compline is it is a kind of liminal service. You know, it's at the end of the day. A lot of the psalms and the language which is used is very much inviting you to stand on the edge of light and dark, you know, forces that you see, forces that you don't see. Mm. And so it's a very evocative service, I think, for taking you to that sense of, well, sacredness, but also perhaps the sublime as well. If the sublime is something which really draws you, but also can be, you know, quite overwhelming even at times, and maybe a bit daunting, but nonetheless something that you want to move towards and try and relate to more, then, you know, Compline is a perfect, and of course the time of day that it tends to occur at, which is in the evening, you know, when you feel differently again, a different kind of consciousness can arise in the evening that's much harder to do in the middle of the day.
Yes,
so it brings a lot of factors together. I wonder also about sort of sacred, maybe creating sacred spaces in other places as well. So, you know, if a cathedral or a church is a sacred place that's marked by its longevity and it's been made sacred by many people over a long period of time. And what about the sense of creating a sacred space, maybe in your home. So, for example, you know, we have a kind of home altar, I suppose you could call it. It's basically just a table, but we have a few icons, a few stones, a few kind of artifacts that we've gathered over the years. Maybe a picture or two that is particularly powerful. So, like one of the pictures we have is the Piero della Francesca picture of the Resurrection, which I find enormously powerful. I really like it. It's in the sort of almost in the centre of our home, literally, and you pass it all the time. Therefore, but it just for me provides a bit of a sort of vertical element in the home, alongside all the horizontal things which you do in the home, like cooking and sitting and watching telly and sleeping and so on. And I like the sense that there's a sacred. It doesn't make the whole home a sacred place, but it draws down a kind of sacred element into the home, I think. So that maybe that's another sense of how to bring about a sacred aspect to life, by, you know, having some sort of... It's sacred, I think, because it's set aside for those objects. You know, they're intentionally put there, they're deliberately put there. We might have gone on a pilgrimage and picked up a stone or bought an icon or something like that. And then it helps you actually, a bit more practically, it just helps you live with these objects and these images, so you pass them and you see it again and it speaks to you a bit more. It's quite a nice way of integrating them into life.
Well, I think that's actually very traditional. I mean, in in most Catholic and Orthodox homes, you'd have an icon or a cross, which would be like the centre of a sacred corner or space. I myself have in my study a wall where I have, icons, and it's like my sacred space where I pray.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I lived in India, I was impressed by the way that in the Indian culture, so much is sacralized. You know, the fire in the heart of each home on which cooking happens, and traditionally an open fire, is a sacred space. The first time I went to India in 1968, I was staying in a village with a remote village in the Himalayan foothills with a herbal doctor, a Brahmin family, and with a friend of mine who was an anthropologist who was living with them. And there was the fire, the woman was cooking on it, and I'd got a piece of rubbish and I was just about to throw it on the fire, you know, to get rid of some scraps of paper in my pocket, and my friend said, just don't do that. You know, this fire is not just for burning rubbish. It's a sacred, it's the hearth. It's the hearth is the centre of the home, and it's the sacred fire. Agni, the fire principle, is sacred in Hinduism. The fire is sacred, and it's where you cook the food, and they make sort of offerings to it. And then, of course, Indian villages have sacred trees, and there's holy animals, holy cows and things. There's so many things there which... And, of course, in traditional Chinese and Japanese homes, they have ancestor shrines. So the sense of these spaces... some people nowadays have meditation rooms. So I think having something in one's home as well, or garden.
Yeah, I mean, actually, just it's in the Judeo-Christian tradition too, but often a bit lost now in the oldest bits of the Bible, where, for example, you know, the gods of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob... are often associated with the hearth, setting up the hearth when Abraham settles underneath the oaks of Mamre, they build a hearth. And the sense of connecting either with ancestral gods or the gods of the place.
Yes.
So it's a very, very ancient idea that fire, which of course, you know, flickers and is associated with spirit and rising and warmth and light and all these things. It's a very powerful symbol. As well as something very practical.
Well, indeed. I suppose that the lighting candles on altars of churches or even in the middle of a dinner table is a living flame, is a kind of symbolic version of that. Well, it's not even symbolic. I mean, it is an actual living flame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that reminds me of another sort of sacred space reference, which is used by the Temenos Academy, who are this group that put on talks and reading groups and so on here in London. And Temenos, you know, it's the Greek for sacred place. The Temenos was the Holy of Holies in the temple. And they mark the sort of slightly different quality of consciousness that they invite you to bring to a talk or to a reading group by lighting a candle at the beginning of every meeting. It's a very simple thing, and it's, you know, it's not really pious, but it does just have that moment where, again, you remember that you're here for something that's sacred, in the sense that, you know, it might speak to you, it might change you, it might open up a different aspect of life to you.
Mm.
And they, you know, deliberately want to invoke that possibility.
Mm.
And it's a very nice practice. You know, you can even do it at home. If you're reading even a poem, it doesn't even have to be particularly sacred, but certainly if you're reading, I'm reading Dante's Divine Comedy at the moment. Again, I've read it quite a few times, and it's very nice just to kind of sit and put something on the table beside me, for example, just to say, you know, I want to read this, and I'm going to do all the intellectual work around it, but I want it to speak to me. I want to be in a slightly different relationship to it.
Mm.
So making it almost like a sacred space around the zone you're reading, it can have quite a powerful effect.
Yes, and indeed, we're lucky in Britain, at any rate, that very soon Nick Mayhew-Smith's book, Britain's Pilgrim Places, is going to be published. Because there's hundreds of sacred places all around the country, not just ancient churches and cathedrals, but also holy wells, springs, river sources, ancient trees. And what his book does is reminds us just how many of these special places there are. And the first edition of his book was called, as you know, Britain's Holiest Places. This is called Britain's Pilgrim Places because the new dimension is adding in pilgrimage, walking there to these places. And so I was looking through the proofs of his book a few days ago, and I was just amazed. I just wanted to go to these places. It just made me want to go. And one of them, I thought, well, I want to start right now. And there was one in London that caught my eye. It's the St. Etheldreda's Church in Ely Place, which is this medieval chapel of the Bishop of Ely, which is now a Roman Catholic church, one of the few medieval Catholic churches in London. And I went there, and I found it down this kind of secret little side street, which I would never otherwise have noticed. And then you have to go along a corridor, and you go up some stairs, and there's this marvellous place with a wonderful feeling of peace and calm, which I would never have known about except for the Nick Mayhew-Smith's book.
Yeah, I mean, I can hardly praise that. The initial book, Britain's Holiest Place, is hardly enough, so I'm really looking forward to the new version as well. Because, you know, it's quite practical, doesn't it? It tells you how to find the street you'd never otherwise go down, and
yes,
follow the corridor and so on. These incredible treasures that, and it might be a very simple well. I remember once one place we visited, you had to get permission to go on the land, but that just meant you had to go to a shop on the high street and get permission. But that extra bit of effort to find the place, which otherwise was off the beaten track. It's just tremendous. I can't wait to see that new book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, here we have wonderful treasures all around us, and potential experience of being in them in a way that's totally eco-friendly as well. You ideally walk to them when you're near them, and it's not emitting any sort of carbon fumes just to be there, except perhaps the minimal amount from a candle you might light.
It's eco-friendly in the practical sense, but I think it's also, in some way, it's about reminding ourselves that that the richest experience in life aren't things that we consume, but the richest experiences are things we contemplate, or presences that we feel. And maybe that's another aspect of sacred space which is finding a new importance and significance even these days.
Well, thank goodness. Well, thanks, Mark.
Cheers for now.